This evening, I'm really pleased to be able to introduce Max Whitby, who is one of the smartest and most creative people it's ever been my good fortune to know. I first came across him when I was a TV critic, and he worked for Horizon. Later on, he and I were non-executive directors of One World International, which was, for a time, the non-profit organisation which ran the biggest civil society website in the world. And if I had to describe him in a single phrase, I would say he was a maker of beautiful things. And not just in a medium that's very ancient, like television, but also in the new media that we are trying to come to grips with. He is currently the chief executive of Touch Press, a publisher of interactive books, indeed beautiful things, which is based in London and Illinois. He's also a filmmaker, a scientist, and the founder of three successful digital media companies. He studied philosophy at an obscure university near Swindon. his name escapes me at the moment. And then he joined the BBC, where he produced numerous Horizon and Nova documentaries. He's directed nearly 100 films, mainly about science. Early on, he became involved in the BBC's pioneering interactive television unit and headed a collaboration with Apple, a small company based near San Francisco. In 2004, I remember when he made the decision, and I have to tell you, I thought he was nuts. He made the radical decision to train formally as a chemist and completed a PhD at Imperial, another obscure university based in London. The skills he acquired then, it turns out, have come in very useful at RGB Research, his London-based scientific research and communications business. For the last 7 years, he's been collaborating closely with Theodore Gray, designing and building elaborate periodical table displays and installations around the world. He's travelled all over the place, and he's had 4 BAFTA nominations, and he's won 2 BAFTA awards. For those of you who don't work in this business, the BAFTAs are the nearest thing we have in this country to Oscars. He also is passionately interested in natural history, and if you're ever on the North Norfolk coast and you see a crumpled middle-aged chap, namely myself, peering at his iPhone and wondering whether what he's seen is a curlew or not, he will be consulting this wonderful guide to the birds of Britain that Max produced, among other things. He's here tonight to talk about a subject that's really important from the point of view of the Arcadia programme. Because one of the things we're having to grapple with, as you well know, is the question of what happens to books, quotes unquote, in a digital environment. And one of the challenges we have is that at the moment, most of the publishing industry, in its traditional brain-dead way, thinks that the Kindle, a device made by Amazon, is in fact somehow the future of the book. And if I were a betting man, I wouldn't put much money on that, but anyway. So Max, I'd like to hear you talk about the future. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that kind introduction, and I hope I can live up to the standard you've set. I'd really like to spend most of this evening showing you things, so I'm going to fairly quickly get on to my iPad and show you both some titles that we've published in the last few months, and I shall give you a sneak preview of some other ones that we're working on that will be coming out soon. And in all these works, we've tried to keep to the spirit of the book, which is something that I love. I love books. I'm sure everyone in this room does too. And my own personal vision of Arcadia... Oh, I've lost my screen. Did it disappear? We've got a dodgy connection.
Funny thing about keynote.
You might have to never ever do anything with technology. Here is my personal Arcadia, which is my favourite bookshop in the world. It's for those of you who've been to Washington DC, near the DuPont Circle. It's a marvellous branch of Olson's, and I particularly like it actually because of all the intelligent staff who work there who really know and love books. And if you go to my house, it's largely filled with the contents of this bookstore that I've bought over many trips over 20 years. And every time I go, I come back with a suitcase full of books, and I always discover things there that are new and different in a way that you can never possibly discover books by going to Amazon. And so I went there last September, looking forward to doing the normal thing. And that's what I saw. And it's every branch of Olsen's and every branch of many other bookstores around the world. And I'm sorry to start on such a depressing note, but we are, as John has alluded, we are in a time of extremely rapid disruptive change in the publishing industry. It's disruptive change at many, many levels, from the distribution of physical books to the whole economics of publishing, to the disintermediation, terrible word but an important concept, the way that publishers themselves are perhaps no longer quite so important as they used to be. Now it's possible for an academic or a journalist or an author to directly communicate with an audience that they reach themselves. Now, the traditional bookshop has been replaced, and from my own personal point of view, I'm delighted that there is somewhere where we can sell our wares, and we, a small company of about 20 people based here in the UK and in the US, can reach the whole world through the iTunes store, the App Store. The App Store, if you are familiar with it at all, does have a bookstore, an iBook store, and mainly there you can buy what I'd call sort of rather thin e-books, thin electronic books, which are really no more than PDFs, digital versions of a printed book with maybe possibly a little bit of video, but essentially not enormously interesting, I think. Where we publish our titles is in the App Store. And this is Solar System, which we published 4 or 5 weeks ago, and it became App of the Week. And the few square inches of real estate there at the top of the App Store on the homepage of the American iTunes is an enormous prize to have got. We're incredibly fortunate to have done so. And for a week, our app was featured there. And it's nothing we could possibly have done to achieve that except to have produced a good piece of work that got noticed and got put up there, mainly based on customer reviews. And that's a theme I shall keep coming back to, that in this new, brave new world of books, it's the quality of what you do that is inescapably tied to your success or failure. So this evening I'm going to talk about Solar System, which is the title bottom right. I'll show you that. I'm also going to talk a little bit about The Elements, which was our first title that came out when the iPad launched in April. I'll tell you a little bit about the history of how I came to be in the right place at the right time, and how we came to make The Elements. It was a team effort, not just me, of course, but it's an interesting story, I think, and one worth briefly telling. And then I'll also give you a sneak preview of our title on Gems and Jewels. It's the ultimate bling app, which is coming out shortly, and I think our most interesting project at the moment, which is with Faber and Faber at T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, and I'm really excited about what we're doing there. Now, these two chaps, is the beginning, I suppose, of my own story of how I got to be here. I had the great good fortune to work with Douglas Adams, who I believe went to university here, and Tom Baker. This was at the time I was making Horizons, John mentioned. And Douglas, about 5 or 6 years before the internet happened, absolutely knew it was going to happen. And so we made a film together called Hyperland, which I think is on YouTube, completely illegally, I'm pleased to say. And in it, he created a character played by Tom Baker, dressed up in a tutu there, that was a sort of embodiment of what the internet would be in the future. It was an interesting piece of work. But I mention it mainly to say I have got this background in filmmaking and television and working with people like these two. And that's part of what we bring to these new kind of books. I'm also very fortunate to have a house away from London on a little island in the North Sea. Some of you may recognise Lindisfarne. And the story of how The Elements came about Oh, where is my house? The story of how the elements came about began one morning about 10 years ago when I was walking around the island, and I thought, I bet I could buy a box of the periodic table. I would actually like to have a box with 92 bottles, and in each bottle a little piece of every element. And I'm sure, I know for a fact I'm not alone. And I went to Google and had a look, and someone had done it, but it was a Russian company who did it in the 70s and went out of business. And I thought, here is a fantastic business opportunity. So I rushed back to London, persuaded my rash fellow directors that this was a thing we would do, and we set about making this very crude box with a lump of everything in it. I now know why the Russian company went out of business. but it was quite fun doing it. And one of the things you have to do is to find lots and lots of elements that are illegal or extremely difficult to get, like plutonium and uranium. And in those days, in the innocent days of... I suppose it was just after the terrible terrorist attacks, but it was possible to buy interesting things on eBay. And I built a lot of the collection by going on eBay and buying bits of uranium, literally. Except the very best, most beautiful lumps of uranium and plutonium and francium and other things would be nabbed by this rascal. And as far as I could see, he and I were the only people in the world trying to collect elements in a systematic way. And that is Theodore Gray. And he's actually sitting, the more observant of you may notice, at a periodic table, which he built and made him famous. And in fact, he won this rather splendid award. Not quite as good as a BAFTA, but almost as good. That's an Ig Nobel Award. It's an award given for something that makes you laugh and then makes you think, a piece of science. I'll give you a sense of the kind of man Theodore was. I mean, to cut a long story short, I decided there was much more to be gained in life by collaborating with him than competing with him. So I went to see him in America. We got on very well. And he is the most extraordinary chap, as you'll see. And here is a short piece of video that gives you a sense. It's 30 seconds long. And it was a response to a competition by Forbes magazine to explain something extraordinary in 30 seconds. I'll let it speak for itself.
How to light a grill in 30 seconds. Jump in the grill.
Pretty much
good to go.
he's a remarkable fellow. And we went out and met him in his farm. He has a farm in the middle of the prairies, which is very convenient for doing this kind of thing. And by that time, between us, we had amassed this absolutely enormous collection around the periodic table. So, of course, it wasn't enough to have one piece of uranium. You have to have 10. And then you start having to collect things that show how uranium is used in our world, making bombs and reactors. So we built up this enormous collection. And by good chance, near where Teo's farm is in the prairies, is a lovely university called DePauw University, a liberal arts college. And they phoned us up one day, having read in the local paper about the collection, and said, would you like to build a periodic table display? We thought, fantastic, at last we've got a use for all these things we've been collecting to no great purpose. When would you like it? And they said, 2 weeks' time, when our new science building is opening. So we rose to the challenge, and working night and day for 2 weeks, we built a periodic table, a sort of cabinet of curiosities, and put inside it many of these objects to create a rather interesting physical display of the periodic table. And so if you look inside, you can see lumps of all the different elements, but also interesting examples of how they're used in the world. So there's some zinc white pigment paint and coins for silver and mobile telephone for India, all that sort of thing. And over the years, we've probably made about 100 of these around the world. There's even one in Cambridge University. And we've also put in interactive videos and that sort of thing. The biggest one we've ever made is in Philadelphia. And it's at the Chemical Heritage Foundation, which if ever you're in that city, I highly recommend you go to. It's a very little-known museum, but a very beautiful, very well-funded museum devoted to the history of chemistry. And we built this sort of centerpiece video for them, which is a video column with essentially 18 high-definition televisions stacked vertically one on top of the other. And the pièce de résistance is this. You might just, before it disintegrates, recognize the face of Dmitry Mendeleev, the Russian chemist. And we call this the Tears of Mendeleev, because his face is actually made up of 660 objects from the periodic table collection, photographed, rotating. I'm telling you all this for a reason, I do promise. And here's what happens when they fall down towards the bottom of this long, tall column. They construct the good old periodic table. So we were very lucky. We got commissioned by Chemical Heritage Foundation about 3 or 4 years ago to build this. And we ended up with photography of 2,500 objects, and each one we photographed in 720 different positions using what was then the best camera we could get, 20-megapixel camera. So we had stacks and stacks of hard disks with all this stuff. And I said to Teo, what on earth have we gone and done that for? You know, what a waste of time and effort. I can't imagine it ever being useful. And he said, you wait. So the one thing we did do is put it on our website. And if you go to periodictable.com, good URL, you can find everything, really, all our absolutely everything we have, freely available in super high resolution for free. And as far as I can see, there's absolutely no way you can really make money out of it, but it's very good, and lots of teachers around the world adore it, and so do their students, and you can drill down into it, and all the stuff is there. We also, in order to make a little bit of money, made a book. This is actually John's copy of the book, and with his permission, I will pass it round and ask him to pass it round and have a look. And this book came out 15 months ago. It did quite well. It sold 60 or 70,000 copies, I think, by April of last year. So in its first 6 months, you know, which is reasonable for a printed book. You'll see it's, you know, rather nice. It has double-page spreads for every element, showing much of the same sort of thing as you see in our various video displays and presentations, and some really witty, sharp text. Because among his other annoying skills, Theodore Gray is a very good writer. He writes a column for Popular Science magazine, which is a big big thing in America. And he's written a couple of other books as well. Then, almost exactly 1 year ago, Moses descended from the mountain and the iPad was announced. And we pricked up our ears at this because we thought, aha, we just happened to be sitting on many terabytes of rotating element objects. We've just written this book. We kind of know the subject. Why don't we do a periodic table? And then you know, it became clear that books could be an interesting new form on the iPad. And if you remember, a year ago, really the whole territory of electronic books and readers was owned by Amazon with the Kindle, which they got out quite a few months before. And Apple had a real problem on their hands trying to differentiate between what a book might be on the iPad and what a book might be on the Kindle. And about the best thing they could come up with, which they advertised prominently in the New York Times, was that its page turn was much more beautiful than on the Kindle. Now, whether this is sort of completely fundamental, anyway, we decided to set out, we had 60 days, and invent a new kind of ebook. And we brought together a group of people, Teo himself, the author, his assistant, brilliant photographer Nick Mann, who'd done all the rotation photography, me with a background in TV and project management, and a very good friend of mine, John Cromie, who I've worked with for 20 years making the bird titles that John mentioned. And he's a brilliant software developer, and in fact had worked at Apple Computer in the QuickTime team there. And so it was a very, very exciting 60 days. And what we ended up with is an app that you can buy on the iTunes store called The Elements. We had to invent an awful lot of things in those 60 days to do it. And I think, I don't know, it's pretentious, but it's sort of the Manhattan Project of apps. You know, having a very definite deadline and a bunch of crazy people together, sometimes you can do good things in a very short space of time. And what we particularly wanted to do is to create essentially an electronic coffee table book that would do things that went beyond the printed page, and not just superficially beyond the printed page, but in a really interesting and deep way beyond the printed page. And that's something we've really tried to do with all our work. Now, I'm just going to repeat that transition. It takes about 0.8 of a second for that animation to happen. There are something like 400 pages in the Elements app, and every one of them does that. And it does that for a whole variety of reasons. One, as the reader, and this is perhaps the most important one, it tells you that these are not just static pictures, that you're going to be able to do something with them. If you watch carefully as they come in, they give a hint of their nature because they turn a little bit, and subconsciously you register that. From our point of view, we were absolutely determined that when you turn the page of a book, it should be immediately and instantly responsive. And actually, that's impossible. It takes 0.8 of a second to load in all the data and files you need to make that page suddenly work. And so we had a problem. When we tried it out, first of all, and just turned the page, people got frustrated because they'd reach out and nothing would happen, and they'd wait a bit, and then it was okay. And actually, it turns out that the iPad can, in its sleep, play that video and leave 99% of its brain going. So this is complete deception. What we do is we entertain you for 0.8 of a second with the objects whizzing in, while we desperately, under the water, load in all the things. So the programmers among you might appreciate that. Here's something else we had to do. By the time we got to a design for the book, we had about 3 days left. And we had to lay out 400 pages, each with completely different objects and text on it. So to solve that problem, we created tools in a marvellous piece of software that, again, I'm very irritated to say Teo wrote, called Mathematica, which is a fantastic piece of engineering software that you'll find in virtually every university department in engineering and mathematics around the world. It's a general purpose software engine for manipulating the world and data about the world. And he was able to create a production system for the Elements that automatically generated every single page in the book from those stacks of hard disks with the raw camera files. So none of them are touched by hand. This is extremely good for production economics. It's also extremely good for reliability. And so to help that process, we created a little simple set of tools that allows you to choose a rotation, say where you want it on the page, change its size a little bit, work out the order, and then press a button and go away for the evening. And when you come back in the morning, your application in theory is compiled. And so the Elements came out on the day that the iPad was launched. When Apple saw it, their little eyes lit up, because they saw here was a way finally to show something that not only the Kindle couldn't do, but the Kindle couldn't possibly do. And it's a different category of thing. It just changed the rules of the game. And there were several other book-like titles that came out at the same time. We weren't by any means unique. But we were probably the exemplar of why the iPad is an interesting thing for looking at electronic books and taking electronic books in new directions. Apple put it on all the iPads in every retail store around the world. Apple put it on all the machines that went out to journalists a few days before the iPad came out. Apple put it in their TV commercials. Apple put it on buses in French, in France. And even then, the French have not leapt to buy it, I'm annoyed to say. But we're grateful for all the publicity. And The lovely thing about the iTunes store is that every morning you get yesterday's sales figures, broken down to every single unit in every currency in every world, in every country in the world. And so you have this incredible rich data that you probably can't read the text along here, but we sort of know the reason for these spikes. This is April when the iPad was launched. This is November when I created the graph. And you can see that although it had a huge spike right at the beginning, the scale is 1,500 units. I think we sold 2,500 units in the first day, and there was one or two. This is when the iPad 3G came out. That was when a TV commercial appeared. It's amazing to sort of see this data flowing in. And to date, it sold very well. We've now sold 300,000 copies in print. The publishers of the printed book, who were a bit worried when we brought out the iPad, are now completely converted and delighted because it's created a lot of publicity. I think anecdotally a lot of people have the elements on the iPad and would like to give it to a friend. And John already has it and has an iPad, but it's nice to give a physical book. It's a much more lasting gift that you know will still be on the shelf in 10 years' time. I think there is a real... It certainly isn't an either-or. There's no way these new electronic books replace. And the electronic book has now sold, well, more like 190,000 copies since April. And it sells at $14. We get $10 of that from Apple. And if you do the maths, that's about $2 million of revenue. Now, to reassure you, we are spending that money as fast as we possibly can on a whole series of titles that will be complete flops. So rest assured.
Can I just ask as a comparison what your margin is on the paper version?
We get a royalty, if we're very lucky, of 10%. And we get that royalty, in theory, about 9 months after the money was earned by the publisher. In practice, it might be 18 months. And in fact, if you read the contract, as I'm sure there are many authors in this room, you will know perfectly well, you get nothing like 10%, because there's a clause that says, should this book be remaindered, or should this book be sublicensed or co-editioned? So you can see why, you know, this is an interesting medium for authors. I can talk a little bit, if people are interested later, about the model we're evolving for working with authors. And the long and the short of it is, we think a royalty of 25% paid 1 month afterwards by direct transfer to your bank account is the electronic book. It's much better. Anyway, with this free money raining down on us, we decided it was time to set up a publishing company because it was too good to be true. And so you met Theodore Gray, that's me in the middle, and the gentleman on the right is Stephen Wolfram, who's Teo's partner in Wolfram Research. And I wanted to call the company Three Bald Men. However, alas, Touch Press ruled the day. So we set up Touch Press in April of last year, and we've been busy as anything for the last year making partnerships and working with other publishers. And when The Elements came out, basically hundreds, and I mean literally hundreds of publishers have contacted us. Basically, they say, "Koo, we like what you've done with The Elements. Can you do it for us? How much can we hire you for to do it?" And the answer is, no, you can't. We want to do things ourselves. We might be interested to partner with you. And that rules out about 80% of the publishers who contact us. But there's a residue of publishers who kind of get it, who have extremely useful resources in terms of expertise, IP, relationships with authors, brands, and who also recognise that we bring to the party not only our software, but also a storytelling ability, a background in media, very rich connections to the software world represented by Mathematica and Wolfram Alpha. And Wolfram Alpha is actually a shareholder in Touch Press, as is Wolfram Research. I don't know how familiar you are with Wolfram Alpha. Who here doesn't know about Wolfram Alpha? So I'd say about just under half. It's essentially a search engine that you can put a query into, and you can access it on the internet, or you can access it via applications. And it's very ambitious. It's attempting to organise and curate more or less the whole of human knowledge. You can go there, wolframalpha.com. If you go and have a look at it and don't know it, there's an example section. But you can, for example, put in the surface area of the moon divided by the population of Cambridge. And if you do that calculation, which takes about a second, it will come back and tell you that each person in Cambridge would, if they were equally distributed on the moon, have 10 square miles or kilometres or whatever it would be. And it's a good example of a question that probably doesn't exist anywhere out there yet. So Google couldn't find it because that fact doesn't exist. But because Wolfram Alpha organises a lot of information, you can put in John and Mary, and what would come back would be two plots of the frequency of that Christian name in America between 1900 and 2000. And there's all sorts of interesting things in other areas of knowledge. And in the context of... so you can integrate things, which if you're a mathematician is impressive. And we build it into our books. So in the elements, you can see how out of date this is. In the elements, you can touch any element and see its current market price. And you need an internet connection, of course. But it's a way of putting up-to-date, up-to-the-minute, reliable facts and figures into your book. And it's interesting, I think, to imagine a whole range of books which, you know, hitherto have had to be published as a static snapshot that can now be made dynamic. So, we've set up Touch Press. We put in an initial starting charge of gunpowder. We've got about 20 people working away, and we're producing half a dozen titles, actually about eight titles at the moment. We took a long time to get our second title out, which is The Solar System, and it came out just before Christmas, and we've got four or five titles that will be out in the first half of this year. And I guess our objective is to try and find out what books are going to be in this new medium. Now, we had a go at this in the 1980s and 90s, and we couldn't possibly have done the elements back in the days of CD-ROM, but some of you will fondly remember that period. I was working in the BBC on this collaboration with Apple at the time, and I think that brings... you could imagine delivering the elements on floppy disks. I think 4,750 floppy disks for all the contents that would be there. We bring together a set of different skills. I think the author in this new medium remains the single most important, the centre of what we try to do. Software engineers, and I put in this lot because... I think there's some very interesting engineers there, if any of you know your history of computing. Software engineers are enormously important, and the whole culture of looking after engineers, motivating them, getting the best out of them, is something that is a very specialised endeavour. The game companies have learned how to do it very well, but the publishers generally don't know how to do it. They don't really know what makes a software engineer tick. And typically, if you look at a big publisher trying to move into electronic books, they will put out a tender and find the lowest bidder and give the contract there. And that's not the way you kind of get the best out of these very strange, creative people. And then you need a background in filmmaking and storytelling and editing, use of audio, all those sort of skills. And although it's very rapidly evolving, there are relatively few places where all those different things come together. And at Touch Press, as I hope I can show you, that's exactly what we're trying to do. So, there's a preamble. That's kind of how I got here. Let me show you some of the things that we've done. So, John, if you could very kindly switch over. Excellent, good. So here are our current range of things that we're doing, and I'm going to start with the elements, just to give you a quick whiz on that. And it begins on this turning periodic table with all those rotations that we had very fortunately done in the museum in Philadelphia. The very first time you launch the song, this happens. I'm sorry, launch the title, this happens.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium. There's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury, molybdenum and magnesium, dysprosium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium and cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.
Well, I'll let that play to the end, because it is a very, very fine song. And Tom Lehrer, I'm delighted to say, is still with us. And we phoned him up in trepidation to say, we'd like to use your song. And he said yes. And the price of the royalty, the license, was one iPad. So good on him. Now you'll notice that the song ended and we are in the application. So it's a nice piece of elegance. The menu was subtly building up as we went along. And I can choose gold, which we've seen before. There's Wolfram Alpha down the bottom. If I touch on that, I'll get the price of gold. Some basic facts and figures. But the main stuff happens on page 2. And so there you saw our little trick. And then the magic occurs when you reach out and touch. And all the objects on this page are objects that you can spin and turn. And I'd argue that that isn't just a gimmick. If you're interested in these objects, it really is. And I'll show you another title we've just done on jewels and gems, where it's just fantastic. Arguably better than the real thing to have this view. So the elements is pretty simple. It has one or two gimmicks. If you double tap on anything, you get a stereo view. And if anyone has a pair of stereo viewers, they can rotate any of the 500 objects in 3D. You just put the glasses. I've got a pair with me. I can show anyone who's interested later on. If you give the iPad a violent shake, which I've done quite often, knocked over glasses of wine, we wrote the code a bit loosely, and so everything rotates. Now, that's the elements. I think I have to say the reason people have bought it in very large numbers has more to do with wanting to show off their iPads than with a deep inherent interest in the periodic table. But I have had quite a lot of people email me and said, I bought your application because I wanted to show off my iPad. But I then started reading it, and actually it's quite good. So I think we have been doing some good things. The other extraordinary thing about the iPad is it's huge. It's 1.7 gigabytes, and we were rather worried when we published it that this would be, you know, a bit of a mouthful. But we have had less than 100 complaints from people about the size of it. Actually, probably less than 50. That's out of getting on for 200,000 people who bought it. So, you know, it's just fantastic the way this digital distribution is now here, not just for small things, but for something as enormous as that. Solar system. There's an awful lot in here. It's a sort of periodic table of planets. And you can see the Sun in the top left, going all the way across to Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. Poor old Pluto, no longer a planet, demoted. And then the Moon's going down. There is a song. I can play it briefly. I'll I'll skip it. It's quite long. It also builds the menu, and so you end up back here on the menu. It's by Björk, the Icelandic singer. There's a reason we're working with her, but I think it's the first example of a major rock star releasing a song, first of all, as a theme song of an app. But to cut to the main part, if we choose Saturn, and I'll choose it because the rings make it sort of easy to see in a demo, you have up here 5 pages on Saturn. So it is actually a book, and I can turn the page, and it's written by Marcus Chown, a Faber author, and on every single page something happens, or you can do something. So on the first page, we've got Saturn itself, and it's a proper full 3D model of the planet, and you can zoom into it, and actually let's go to Jupiter. I can also navigate at the bottom here with a rocket. So here Jupiter's better. I can zoom into the great red spot, and I can tumble. I mean, now I can not only rotate, but I can also go left and right. And up here is a very important icon. It's called the orrery. And here is where we really, really go beyond the printed page, because every planet in the book links into a working 3D model of the solar system that you can zoom into. And you can play with it. You can make somewhere else the center of the universe. So now that's Europa, and we're looking at the universe with... and I can play with time, I can speed it up. And so there's a Europa-centric universe with the other planets coming and going. And if we zoom right into Europa and look at it in detail, I'd encourage you to come and look at a screen... Look at it actually on the iPad screen. In fact, IO might be a better bet. Is that IO? That is NASA data. All of this is the actual data from NASA wrapped around those spheres. It's not an artist's impression. We have played around a little bit. If you click on the question mark there, you get a bit of an explanation about the history of the orrery. We've also told you the liberties we've taken with scale and time. But basically, the model of the solar system that we've built is accurate, at least in terms of the relationships between different things. And I can make the Sun the centre of the universe again to restore matters to its proper place. I can make Earth the centre of the universe. There's the Moon going around the Earth. Let's make the Moon the centre. Now imagine you're explaining to a child why actually the Sun doesn't go around the Earth. It's a very nice way of doing it. And you can really learn through not just hearing something or reading something, but by doing and playing and experimenting. And I'm sure those of you who teach will know the power of that. But this is a book, and so we're in a working orrery of the solar system, and if I want to find out about the Sun, I double tap on it, and I'm back in the book on that page, and I've got a explorable Sun. Every page needs to do something. There's a reason for the bananas. Apparently, if the Sun was made of bananas, it would still burn. We've also tried to use video in different ways. This is something we're just beginning to explore, but we want to get away from video in a rectangle with a play button. It's well illustrated on this page, I think, where we're integrating video into the design of the page. The flares go behind the text. But you can read this book through from beginning to end. You can play with the individual things that are here. We do have a wonderful gallery, a collection of about 600 of the very best NASA and Japanese Space Agency and European Space Agency photos, which are zoomable, pinchable. And down here you have a caption, a double-sided caption, shamelessly nicked from the Guardian Eyewitness app, those of you who know, that has kind of headline about what you're looking at, but then on the back, technical details about how the image was created. I'll finish on solar system and now move on to some fantastic things in here. Come and have a play with it afterwards, or even better, buy it. Gems. This is the Bling title that I was referring to. They're not quite ready yet, but it's essentially, you can imagine, having seen the elements, how one might move on to a collection of beautiful gems and jewels. Let's go and take a look at opal. You see that same clever movie coming in. And for every object, we've got marvellous rotational photography. And this is based on an existing book published by Cambridge University Press, who are our publisher partners in the project. We've co-funded it with them. And it shows off the beautiful screen and the beautiful interface really, really well. I do encourage you to come and have a play afterwards. I've got some images I could show, perhaps just briefly back onto the main projector.
Yep.
Of how we went about photographing the images there. And you can perhaps see it a little bit better on that screen, the sort of quality of the images rather than on the camera and the iPad. But we photographed all these fantastic objects, $250 million worth, at night in the Field Museum in Chicago, under armed guard. So if you look very carefully, you'll see the guard has a small pistol in case we run off with anything. And we worked with the people who curate the collection there, and that's the world's largest cut topaz. That's Nick Mann with a cushion there to catch the topaz if it were to fall. But from the sublime to the possibly even more sublime, the wasteland. I'd like to finish by showing you a preview of a title that I hope we're going to publish in April, very appropriately. Our software engineer is currently asking Faber if we could change the first line of the poem to May is the meanest month. Possibly July is the jauntiest month. So, John, sorry to get you up and down like a yo-yo. If we can go back to the camera. And I'll need to go up a little bit because, as you see, we use the orientation of the iPad for certain features.
Want me to hold it?
No, I think probably better if I do. So, T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. It's very austere compared to our other titles. But the heart of it is a performance of Eliot's poem that we filmed with the actress Fiona Shaw. And I'm just going to play that probably for a minute or 2 minutes, if you don't mind. I think it's important to actually experience it for a bit. And it starts very, very slowly. If you turn the iPad on its side, you can just watch it full screen. And at a certain point in the proceedings, I'm going to turn it on its side and we'll take a look at some of the things we can do with it.
The Wasteland. The Burying of the Dead. April is the cruelest month. Bleeding lilacs out of the dead land. Mixing memory and desire. Stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprised us, coming over the Starnbergersee with a shower of rain. We stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. Bin gar keine Huschestamm, außer Teuen, echt Deutsch. And when we were children, staying at the Archduke's, my cousin, he took us out in a sleigh, and I was frightened. He said, Marie! Marie! Hold on tight! And down we went. In the mountains, there you feel free. I read much of the night and go south in the winter. What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images where the sun beats, and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Only there is shadow under this red.
So I'm going to interrupt her with apologies and show that I can jump around the poem by scrolling. I can also move backwards and forwards through the video. And as I've moved backwards and forwards through the video, the poem scrolls to catch up. And so it's a quite natural combination of the two media. If, let's just stop her for a moment and bring up some other readings we have of the poem. We've got T.S. Eliot reading the poem himself at two phases in his life, in 1933 and later as an older man in 47. Actually, this is my favourite reading.
Come in under the shadow. What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images where the sun beats and the dead tree.
And the dry stone, no sound of water.
Ted Hughes.
Only there is shadow under this red rock. Come in.
Vigo Morgenstern, Fiona Shaw again.
Come in under the shadow of this red rock.
So it's interesting to hear different people's readings and interpretation of the poem.
Shadow at morning.
Then, very, very important, we have perspectives on the poem. And again, that's something that you turn the iPad to see. And we have about 40 pieces of interview. Let's choose Seamus Heaney.
The death by water section of the Westland. A part that, when I read it first, I read it under the...
We have...
It's only more.
Paul Keegan, who's the current poetry editor at Faber.
More and more nuanced.
The novelist Jeanette Winterson.
The radio and the gramophone. And those are probably biographical details which tell us a lot about how he was thinking when he was writing the Westland and how he could use those voices. Because with
and then
the idea that, you know, the
Craig
Rayne,
very interesting academic on the poem, and Fiona Shaw herself,
I mean, we take
talking about her experience
we
of reading
the
poem.
Porno cinema. And people came, we had sort of portaloos outside. And people came with their chihuahuas in their limousines and had to go past the portaloos to go into a place. And somehow, place can also put you in touch with things. But in a way, talking about the Thames there became the, you know, the Hudson became the Thames.
And then finally, we have notes on the poem, so that if you want, you can have a massive, detailed exegesis explaining all the many, many rich references in the poem. You know, the many references that Eliot himself made to literature and other sources in art. So we're a month or so away from producing that, but as I say, it's a title that I'm very excited about. Trying, I think, to do for the periodic table what The Elements has done, and bring a dry subject that perhaps not enough people appreciate to a new digital audience. So I think, John, that's not a bad point to stop
okay.
about the right
Thank
time.
Thank you very
so.
Much. Well, I said at the beginning that he's a maker of beautiful things. Maybe you can see what I mean. We have about 15 minutes for questions and conversation. So who would like to start?
In your Wasteland, the video is very much a core part of that experience. As it seems. Would you be releasing
I don't think a book could capture anything new. I mean, there's such a huge, rich literature on Eliot that I think the best we can do is to take the best of the printed word and make it more accessible through the electronic medium. But In the case of the solar system, we commissioned Marcus Chown to write the text there, brand new for the application. And now Faber is working on a book based on that text. So it might be an early example of the electronic medium and the printed medium working hand in hand.
I'm a humble self-publisher, and I've probably sold about 1% of the copies that you've sold, and I'm completely daunted now, because it seems to me that the technological requirements of authorship are going to be horrendous for somebody who's a little agent or on his own. Can you give me any comfort?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, the first thing I should say is that you are the irreducible vital ingredient of these works. So if you were a publisher and I was talking to you, I would sort of not have a lot of cheerful things to say. But as an author, I think it's a fantastic medium where you can directly address an audience. And to do the sort of things that we've shown you, yes, do take a lot of software engineering. But that's very rapidly going to change. And just as now you can buy a package that allows you to produce beautifully laid out printed books, you know, with fonts and type and design, exactly the same thing's going to happen in this medium. And there will be software and packages that allow individuals to, you know, maybe not do the absolute front level of work, but where the story that you tell, the content that you have, that's what matters, and the technology shouldn't get in the way of that or be necessary to do something wonderful.
Question there?
I was going to ask a similar question. How do you see the industry moving? I mean, do you see it becoming dominated by kind of blockbuster books, which make tens of millions of dollars to produce in 10 years' time?
No. I think it will be a rich ecosystem where there'll be some game-like, movie-like blockbusters, but there's enormous room. I mean, The Wasteland, for example, didn't actually require a blockbuster budget. And I think you could take that approach and do, you know, some existing piece of work that you love, maybe one that's out of copyright, and you could do a fantastic similar sort of treatment for 3 or 4 months' work. Certainly it wouldn't require multiple hundreds of thousands of pounds. The sort of budgets we're looking at are between $50,000 and $250,000 per title. That's the sort of scale. So it's not in the feature film league, it's more sort of television programme league. And Solar System was our most expensive title so far. That cost $250,000. And we've just received a cheque from Apple for the first month sales of $254,000. So, you know, we made it back. So it is a viable proposition if you can pull together the right pieces.
Phil?
Thanks. My colleague here mentioned the industry, and I wonder which industry he meant, actually. I was listening, particularly the last section, and thinking about broadcasting. I think it's very striking how, I mean, CD-ROMs felt almost quaintly dated within minutes,
yeah.
and broadcasters always seem to have failed in their ambition online. I want to know whether you think that the rare mix of capabilities and insights in how to manage them that you seem to have corralled is an exception, whether you're an outlier, or whether you're an indication of how a new industry somewhere between publishing and broadcasting is being formed.
Well, I hope it's the latter. And I see lots of signs of that. Touch Press is one of the first companies to try and claim this space, and I sometimes feel like we've broken into the Garden of Eden. Mm-hmm. But there are others now, and there will be more soon. And there's two things I would say that are absolutely critical to our ability to produce good things and for them to sell. One is partnerships. Partnerships with publishers, partners with authors, with institutions who have interesting material. And I think that isn't just a case of how the world is moving in publishing. I think it's a general phenomenon in the 21st century that organisations can't exist on their own. They have to partner at every scale. And the other thing that's critical is the channel. And I can't stress enough how important that iTunes store is, with its ecosystem of publicity and promotion, and its beautiful mechanism. You know, it's a fantastic thing. And Steve Jobs did it for the music industry, and it looks like he's done it, or is doing it now, for the publishing, information publishing industry. There are lots of other tablets coming out, Android and many other manufacturers, and they will not succeed if they don't have something like the iTunes Store.
Yeah. Jonathan?
You sort of answered the question already. I was going to ask about the economics of the project, so I don't know any other more detail on that.
I mentioned earlier on that if people were interested, I could tell you briefly the model we're evolving. If you sell a title for $14 through the iTunes Store, which is what Solar System and Elements and probably Wasteland are going to cost, we get 70% of that. We get $10, and we, with our partners, divide that up into three pieces. We say 25% is for the author. We say 25%. Is for us, Touch Press, for bringing our software, our production expertise, our brand, our marketing ability. And the remaining 50% is available for however the title gets funded. Now, in the case of most of the projects we're doing, we 50-50 fund with the partner we go in with. And so, under that simple model, if the partner is the author, or the partner is a publisher who owns the Wasteland, we simply split the net revenues down the middle 50-50. And under that sort of scenario, with budgets in the range £25,000 up to, say, £100,000 and £150,000, you need to sell somewhere between 10 and 30,000 units to make your money back, which seems to be achievable. I mean, we're making this up as we go along, and we were very worried when the Solar System came out that, it would sell a few thousand. But it hasn't. It sold 35,000, and we haven't translated it yet into other languages, and we think something else that's very interesting is the other ways you can generate revenue. You can sell updates, you can keep your title fresh, you can have in-app purchases. So we think Alec Guinness might be an in-app purchase. You can see the poor fellow rotating in his grave.
Quentin.
I'm thoroughly impressed with the technology and the aesthetics, but I'm almost impressed with your licensing achievements here in terms of, I suppose that's the question, the T.S. Eliot stuff. How much of that material did you create for the project, and how much did you have to license from other people?
Well, actually, that's a good question, because I should mention that BBC Arena are also a partner in the project, and they produced a lovely film on Eliot, and the director of that film, we hired them to shoot the performance with Fiona Shaw. So, in the case of the Wasteland, about half of the content existed. And interestingly, it didn't exist in a transmitted film. It existed in the rushes of that film, which we went back and raided. The other half we created anew. Solar System was largely created from scratch. And that's why it cost quite a lot more. We do in our marketing blurb, with hand on heart, say that the production budget of the app was about $1 trillion. Was it several readers or one reader?
It was a site dramatized production with a group of six actors, which I was involved in directing.
Was that the recent one? It was one
no, this is going back for 7 years ago. What I was going to ask you about, though, was that it obviously looks like a very useful app for students who are studying the text. Is there any facility for them to kind of annotate or take notes?
Yes, we have included the ability to leave your own personal notes there, but it's not in any sense a textbook. And in fact, all the things we do are educational with a small e, if you like. There are other companies who are very aggressively developing classroom materials, and Teo Gray, our creative director, has a very strong polemic to basically say that the textbook publishers are doomed, that, particularly in an academic context where teachers, professors, lecturers generate rich material, now why bother with a publisher? You don't need to send it to China to be printed and shipped back on a cargo boat, you can put it straight out. Where I think there is room in the educational space is to do things like the Wasteland that provide extra rich, enhanced material that are the sort of things you give to your children if you want them to get interested in the subject, or a teacher can share around the class to motivate. That's where we have a place,
thank you. Andrew?
I have a multi-part question. The first is, the people who purchase these apps, what do you call them? Are they readers? Are they users?
Readers.
And then, readers, what do you know about them? What kind of data are you collecting about how people use these applications? And has that changed the way you build future books?
Not enough is the short answer. There is a technology that you can build in, supplied by Google, you probably know it, that will track very precisely every page, how long everyone watches. We don't want to do that because I think we would alienate some part of our audience. We don't get from Apple any kind of demographic data. They're very protective of that. Our only direct contact with our customers comes from people who buy 3D glasses. And that's about 3% of our market. And so we know a little bit about them. And insofar as we've done any analysis, we seem to be seeing exactly the same cross-section of people who are buying iPads. So it tends to be well-educated, fairly wealthy people who are interested in the sort of subject areas that we've been producing books for.
Richard?
I love the way that the technology brings educational subjects to life, and I think that's a big part of the T.S. Eliot work. Is there anyone writing fictional content with this delivery mechanism in mind? And I mean creating content before, rather than sort of retrofitting.
We've had quite a few authors contact us and say we'd like to work with you. I'm personally sceptical about whether fiction is going to be successful in this medium. I think there's one very, very, very successful example so far, and that's games. And I told you the typical budget for the titles we're doing is 25,000 to 250,000. That would be the typical budget for the very first early prototype stage of a game. And you know, most games budget these days are in the £5 to £10 million range. I think it clearly works. I'm not sure it's hugely interesting direction to go. I think there is a lot that we could do along the lines of the Wasteland in bringing fiction to life through interpretation and understanding. Certainly in modern novels and so on would be fantastic in this medium. But I don't want a plot to be interactive. I mean, this gets into the whole question of whether there's a logical contradiction between narrative and interactivity. And I'm in the camp that rather believes there is, and that you should use interactivity for the things it's good at.
Okay. We have time for one more question.
Well, I use my iPad a lot for children that read, mainly boys, and comic type, simplification of a novel, like a graphic novel, and that's very successful, and boys get very excited about reading this kind of book.
And but they're essentially, it's a linear, but it's a linear experience that they're going through mainly. Well, there's a huge range of good things you can do in this medium, and it doesn't all need to be sophisticated. Yeah.
Okay, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I just want to say thank you very much for coming, and I want to ask you to thank Max for his presentation.